Here for the Lowe's early Black Friday deals? You're right on time for some of our biggest savings. We're talking up to 50% off select major appliances, plus up to an extra 25% off when you bundle select major appliances. Holiday lights going up soon? Select ladders are up to 50% off right now. Get Black Friday prices without the Black Friday crowds. Lowe's, we help you save. Valid through 11/19. Selection varies by location. Select locations only. While supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details.
Worried about your future in tech? Master new skills, accelerate your team's impact, and redefine what's possible with Pluralsight. We're more than just another online learning platform. We're shattering the skills gap and shaping future generations of technologists. Transform your work. Transform your team. Ready to tap in? Visit us at Pluralsight.com to learn more.
It's The Wonky Show. We're talking about Dundee and a discussion in Scotland about a university in crisis. There's new data for us to unpack about student well-being, and we're picking up the threads of elections around the world and what their outcomes mean for students and universities. It's all coming up.
But for international students, they're coming and actually paying a fee to access this. So, you know, from their point of view, they haven't experienced it. They don't understand what it is. All they know is, okay, this, it feels like private healthcare to them to a certain degree. Oh, at least I can pay to access some health.
Welcome back to The Wonky Show, your weekly way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm your host, Mark Beach, and joining me on the road to recovery for the HE policy conversation this week, we have three fantastic guests as always. In Tooting, it's Chris Shelley, Director of Student Experience at Queen Mary University London. Chris, your highlight of the week, please.
Well, my highlight, Mark, was going into London on Sunday for the London Marathon and cheering on everyone who was doing that, feeling a little bit jealous that I wasn't doing it, although it was a bit warm. And a big shout out to Hayley Fuller from Queen Mary and Charlotte Kendrick from our Students' Union, who both smashed it on Sunday.
Lovely. In Glasgow, it's Rachel McSween, Director of Partnerships and Stakeholder Engagement at IDP. Rachel, your highlight of the week, please.
I'm having two, Mark, if that's okay. Personally, Girls Weekend has finally made it out the group chat and we're going to Porto the weekend, leaving tomorrow. And professionally, we launched our seventh iteration of our Emerging Futures student sentiment research yesterday, which is linked often to students changing their minds about destinations based on global policy changes, of which there's quite a few at the moment. So it was great to get that launched and out into the public.
Very good. And in Oxford, it's Michael Salmon, Wonky's news editor. Michael, your highlight of the week, please.
Morning, everyone. My highlight this week, by request of my son, is that he managed to get dressed in the morning in 1:20, which he thinks is a new world record and is definitely much faster than he normally manages it. He did actually ask me to put it in the daily, but I thought maybe this would be better.
A lot faster than anyone in this household gets dressed, that's for sure. Right, if we start the week in Dundee, Michael, what's going on?
Yeah, so if you've been following Scottish higher education at all in 2025, by far and away the big topic has been a sort of financial situation, financial crisis really at the University of Dundee, you know, more than new legislation, international recruitment, student numbers, anything. It's just loomed incredibly large, comes up at First Minister's questions, Education Secretary is repeatedly asked about it. So to catch everybody up, the Scottish government has already, via the Scottish Funding Council, then they're not allowed to directly give supports, but £22 million in support has been given, some in loans, some in grants. The university had said it would not have any cash on hand by May without sort of being propped up. The government and the SFC have launched both an independent investigation into governance. There's also, they've put together a recovery task force to sort of think longer term. So it really, it's just been, you know, all over the news. And so what's happened this week? Well, the university's initial sort of financial recovery plan, as they're calling it, set out plans for a really, really high number of job losses. It was going to be more than 600 full-time equivalent. So, you know, even in excess of that. And that was before the government, the initial government support, which was sort of focused on short-term liquidity, before that was announced. And this week, we've had a new plan come forward from the university after sort of consultation and discussion. And it's, you know, more modest, still, you know, not ideal by any means. They're talking about the reduction of up to 300 staff full-time equivalents, but this time through voluntary severance, you know, and also lots of the usual new borrowing arrangements, restructuring how their schools and faculties work and finding other ways to save costs. You know, so in that sense, it sounds very similar to what a lot of universities are doing all over the UK. But the kind of big caveat here is that, you know, doing this plan that the universities come up with, in their words, will require significant additional public funding. So it's dependent on the government, or at least the Scottish Funding Council, coming up with additional funds, which they have in the past indicated they are open to considering. And Education Secretary Jenny Gilruth again said the same thing today, that it, you know, when the details emerge, the government will again consider it. So, you know, we for quite a lot of, you know, 2023, 2024, we've been talking about, okay, what would a government's response be? What would the different UK governments respond if a university got in serious financial trouble? You know, over the last couple of months, we've really got an answer, an emerging answer in Scotland, at least. How that translates to, you know, additional universities being in the same situation or in the other UK nations is still pretty unclear.
Rachel, why is this a bigger issue? Why is this cut through in Scotland, also across the UK? And I mean, the situation at Dundee is not that dissimilar to a lot of different universities, is it?
No, and there's plenty of universities that are looking at as big shortfalls in their finances as Dundee are. They've kind of become the poster child for it a little bit in Scotland, at least. And I think when I was thinking about it, I was thinking about, like, why it's happened. And I think probably the reasons why it's happened speaks to the worst fears of a lot of other universities as well, because they're also in similar situations. I suppose, naturally, my lens is always going to go to international student recruitment, or student recruitment more broadly, and kind of why the decline in numbers of international students going to Dundee has probably been a big contributor to the situation they find themselves in, as well as things like operational costs and inflation. And there are allegations of financial mismanagement as well, which maybe we won't get into today. But I think from a student recruitment perspective, it does speak to the worst fears of a lot of institutions that have a similar recruiting profile to Dundee. They were probably disproportionately impacted by the collapse in the Nigerian market that caused by the devaluation of the Naira, but also the change to the dependent visa in 2023 really kind of put paid to a lot of international students from Nigeria coming to the UK. Just from a data perspective, in 2022, there were 65,000 Nigerian students. In 2023, it was 18,900. So that's a 68% decline. And a lot of that linked to both the currency issue and the dependence issue. And I think Dundee have had a very long and illustrious and successful recruitment history in Nigeria. They have a big footprint there. They have great partnerships. And I think just the decline has obviously completely blown some of their recruitment out of the water. My colleague James and I, though, were up in Dundee a couple of weeks ago meeting with their director and the head of international. And they've got a new Pro Vice Chancellor of International, Kim Dale, who took over from Wendy Alexander. They are so committed to the promotion of the degrees at Dundee, and they're working closely with the recruitment partners like us and others to really give that message of reassurance, not just to the recruitment partners, but directly to students, parents, teachers, and making them feel confident in applying to the university. And I know the messages that the kind of emphatic press release that came out this week from the acting VC is saying, have confidence in the university, have confidence in being able to apply here and know that you'll be successful. And I think that is definitely being underpinned by the support package that the SFC is stepping forward with.
Chris, do you think it's a ultimately net good thing that there's this amount of attention and sort of political interest in one university? I mean, if this was to happen to a university in England, and, you know, the Secretary of State was talking about it, there were committee hearings, it was in, you know, front page newspapers the whole time, I think people would feel like this is, you know, in the sort of classic secretary way, like, you know, a bit uncomfortable. We don't like, you know, we don't like it when the lighthouse is sort of shining its massive light on things that are going wrong in the sector for all sorts of reasons, you know, a lot of them good reasons, confidence, recruitment, etc. But at the same time, there are universities in significant financial distress, aren't they? And they do want help, and they do want to put pressure on the government to stump up with money, which is what is happening in Scotland, or looks like it might. So kind of where's the balance here between the sort of, you know, Rachel said it's a poster child is quite a good way of putting it. You know, no one wants to be the first poster child or the guinea pig, or, you know, choose your own metaphor, do they? But at the same time, they do want more support.
No, absolutely. And certainly if the first major story about a university in significant crisis is one of ultimately it being saved and supported and, you know, surviving, then that's far better than it being, you know, the opposite and it ultimately ending in a closure. I mean, I took two positives from this story. One is quite obviously the simple fact that Dundee are looking to be able to save around 300 jobs from their original projected numbers. You know, every university that's in these situations is going in and having to look at how to reduce costs. But nobody wants to lose jobs. You know, nobody wants to be reducing these numbers. So to be able to have come up with a plan which saves those jobs is absolutely, you know, hugely a positive thing. But the most important positive thing was the fact that it's clearly a part of a dialogue, as part of a dialogue with the Scottish Funding Council. The fact that the secretary was so quickly coming out with a statement, you know, this wasn't something where the Scottish Government and the SFC have said, right, go on, sort your house out, come back when you've sorted it. It's your problem that you've created, you've got to fix it. It was clearly, this plan is clearly being put together with lots of people around the table looking at options. And it's not that the university have come out and said, well, the only way we can do this is if we get tens more millions of pounds from the government. What are you going to do about it? And the government have said, well, hang on a minute, it's nothing to do with us. Actually, this is clearly, you know, a plan which is joined up, which is really positive that the SFC and the Scottish Government are willing to take those steps to support it. But as you say, the kind of knock-on effect there is, well, what next? Who's next? Does that open the floodgates for the whole of the UK to sort of start putting together plans that basically say, okay, well, we'll do some of our bits, but also can we have a, you know, a few tens of millions for the next few years from the government, please? And you know, that's not going to be sustainable. And therefore, if the outcome of this is that really puts the pressure on Labour to revisit the issue more seriously around the whole funding model, you know, we all know why we're here. There's a couple of very big reasons why we're here, and the fact that the funding model was ignored for 10 years is the main one. Just sticking RPI interest on the current tuition fee rate is not going to solve this problem. So if this flags to Labour, you know, that actually the government need to look at this and find a different funding model that is sustainable, that supports universities to come out of this particular crisis, but also thrive moving forward, then they need to do that. Otherwise, there'll be an awful lot more of these cases that will require specific intervention.
I'm interested in this kind of moral hazard thing, Michael, because, you know, clearly, as Chris says, you can't, not everyone's going to be able to be bailed out, are they? And not every institution. So how do we, you know, how are they going to draw the line?
Yeah, I think Chris has sort of put his finger on it there, really, that it's, you know, I think taken externally, it can seem that there is an enormous risk of exactly what you said, this moral hazard that if the government steps up to help out, to support one institution, then why would another institution not just try and sort of, you know, do the same thing? That, you know, the government support for universities acting as a safety net encourages more risky behavior in the future. You know, it's a sort of, it feels like a sort of classic economic study, right? But I think the difference is, as we've just been talking about, that there's an enormous amount of sort of collaborative and careful discussion going on behind the scenes that you don't think about, you know, that you don't hear about, both especially with SFC, but, you know, and at a slightly further remove with, you know, with both the Scottish Government and individual MSPs and trade unions. You know, that has always been how the Scottish sector has worked, that, you know, there's sort of lots of collaboration behind the scenes, that there's often a bit of a lack of transparency on how decisions are made, is the sort of flip side of that. But that's another reason why I think it's interesting to think, how does this translate over into England, where the HE sector has, you know, in the last decade or more, has been sort of set up in a slightly different way. You know, in to an extent, at least, universities are seen as being in competition with each other. And there's also, you know, I think less sort of public appetite for, you know, if we think about how the media would react if it emerged that there were sort of secret, as it were, negotiations going on with government and universities, you know, that you can sort of imagine some of the headlines that would be generated in a way that would likely discourage the government from doing too much, if, you know, to the extent that it can help it. I think the situation in England would end up being quite different. Another reason is also because of the elections coming up. You know, they're only a year away in Scotland now. You know, Dundee has two Scottish National Party MSPs. One of them is Finance Secretary Shona Robison. So, you know, and given that as well, I think the main thing the SNP is worried about in the election campaign, or, you know, one of the key things, is sort of how it's seen as managing the public sector. You know, it's sort of managerial competence in a way that is just very different from where we are in Westminster at the moment, both in terms of the cycle, but also in, you know, what are the sort of political narratives.
I've got a question on that, I suppose, Michael, with the public services in mind. I think the University of Dundee's got a massive teaching hospital, Ninewells Hospital in Dundee, which is a huge supplier of NHS services in the region. I wonder how much of the government's decision to step in to support is linked specifically to the healthcare provision that the university provides for quite a wide geographical region of Scotland.
Yeah, I think that's part of it. I think there's also things, you know, that Dundee's historical and, you know, continuing strengths in life sciences, you know, is another enormously important thing for the government. Just in general, the sort of the Dundee's role as an employer and as a sort of anchor in the city is, you can see how key it is in all these discussions, you know, and there is a different way that, you know, the voice of staff and the voice of, you know, local groups comes across in, you know, in the debates you see in Scotland. You know, lots of MSPs are briefed by and are closely working with and speaking to UCU and other trade unions in a way that, you know, you don't quite get the sort of government disconnect from what's happening in a way that it can sometimes feel like in England. I mean, yeah, I think that's definitely right, Rachel, that, you know, there's very specific things that the government is very, very keen to connect in Dundee, healthcare being one of them.
And another question, sorry, I'm asking you the questions now, Mark and Michael. Is there kind of an insolvency playbook framework that exists for universities? Do we know what would happen? Or is that still being worked out if universities did collapse? Like, what would happen to the students? What would happen to the teach out of degrees? Do we know?
Yeah, I mean, I guess we haven't seen it play out in a kind of the extremity of, you know, University X goes bust, must stop teaching immediately or within a year or two. What do we do with these students? Where we've seen the institutions come to a crisis point, they've been able to essentially merge with somewhere else, or, you know, where programs have been closed in order to preserve the overall future of an institution. There are obviously arrangements in made. The student protection plan should set out the kind of teach out arrangements, how long it will take, where the students could be transferred to if they need to, etc. So I'm not sure we have seen this play out in a way that gives us a case study just yet, especially given, you know, the whole sector is facing this to a certain degree one way or another. So yeah, we all watch with interest.
Yeah, and I think it's noticeable in England that the Office for Students has very recently said to universities that, you know, they should be thinking about updating their student protection plans. You know, it's something they should be carefully considering, which essentially suggests that the regulator thinks that a lot of them are not currently fit for purpose for the, you know, for the situation we find them in. And of course, it seems to have a longer term project to essentially do away with student protection plans and manage student protection in a different way. That's something it's consulting on at the moment, or has just finished consulting on for new providers. But it's suggested that it would, you know, longer term, like to extend that more widely. So yeah, I think, as Chris says, I think we're really a little bit in the dark what would happen if a large multi-faculty, you know, civic university were to really go into insolvency.
Right, let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
Hello everyone, I'm Catherine Lloyd-Clark and I've been writing on Wonky about the undergraduate student recruitment landscape this summer. I wanted to draw attention to the way in which the UCAS Decline My Place function has actually created post-qualification admissions without much of the sector really realising. When most of the emphasis was on international number growth and home numbers were relatively static, this development didn't really have the potential to create much turbulence. But it struck me that in 2025, with international numbers very challenging and many providers looking to grow their home undergraduate numbers, there was the potential for really quite an unsettled numbers game when we come to confirmation and clearing this summer. So I wanted to explore that and the way in which apparently small changes can potentially have a really, really big impact for all of our students and stakeholders. So I hope you enjoyed the article and I certainly enjoyed writing it.
Okay, now we published new data from Belong, our student insight panel, all about student health and wellbeing. Rachel, give us the highlights, please.
Yeah, this was on the site and on the daily this week, so hopefully people have seen this really interesting research. So the focus was on student health, both mental and physical. I think over 1,000 students responded to the survey. And they were reporting, of the ones that responded, they were reporting quote unquote good health at much lower rates than the general population. Most of those surveyed were registered with a GP, which is great to know they've got support available to them, although sometimes the GP was in their home area rather than closer to the university, and much fewer were registered with a dentist. Housing came up as a notable factor impacting health, but the stereotypes that we maybe all have of students that are drinking heavily and misusing drugs seemed far from the case with the answers that came back from the students. And Wonky have also been asking students about what should be done about a mental health crisis or physical health crisis. Students responded saying, amongst other things, they wanted to see expanded mental health services at universities. Interesting one here, less academic pressure, cheaper gyms and free sexual and reproductive health products on campus.
Interesting. So, Chris, I mean, I want to come to you first, obviously, because you're director of student experience at a university. So first of all, how much of it kind of rings true and chimes with your own work on students at Queen Mary?
Yeah, I mean, I think it massively rings true. I think it's great to see an evidential basis for some of the things that we felt for a while and that we're seeing for a while. You know, it's really important that we don't disconnect physical and mental health. And I think what this survey outcome shows us, and the qualitative comments as well, actually really shows us, is just how interconnected those two things are. There was one comment that was very stark, that one student who'd filled it in said, "My physical health is immaculate. However, my mental health is the worst it's ever been." And that, you know, that to have the two elements of your health at the complete opposite ends of a spectrum, you know, that's not a coincidence. That we often see, and what we try with our services to connect our gym staff, for example, with the, you know, counselling service to be able to refer students in one direction or the other. Sometimes a student who is experiencing a mental health crisis absolutely needs to focus on their physical health. They need to eat better. They need to do more exercise, and that will have a positive impact on their mental health. But you can also see students who are in the gym 6 days a week, not eating properly, losing weight, obsessing over their weight or obsessing over their physical health, that actually also might also be a trigger or a sign of a situation with their mental health as well. So it's really important that we as universities delivering services see this as a joined up issue. Completely unsurprised by some of the things that come through in terms of, you know, the impact that going to university has on our students' health and mental health. And a lot of it does come back to similar themes that have come out from the Belong survey before. You know, students who are cash poor are also therefore time poor. They make bad choices. Those bad choices can lead to, you know, bad diets. It can lead to being unhealthy. It can lead to living in accommodation that's not safe. It can lead to lack of sleep, etc. So all of these things, you know, all of these pressures that are impacting on our students from so many different ways, social pressure, academic pressure, financial pressure, all have, you know, an impact, mostly negative, on our students. Interestingly, there are some good stories in there around, well, actually, when I live in a shared house with friends I get on with, and we share the cooking and we support each other to be healthy, that actually is a really positive thing. And that's great to see as well. So it's not all doom and gloom. But yeah, I think some of the concerns that come out are very, very, you know, ring very true.
And I guess, Michael, is to raise also the perennial problems, isn't it, of kind of governance of these problems and kind of whose responsibility students are.
Yeah, it totally does. I mean, in some of the solutions, both that, you know, we've talked about on the site before, but also that students have come up with themselves in the research, some of them are just simply about funding, you know, things like expanded mental health services. You know, they cost money, or, you know, subsidized sexual health products, or subsidized gym use. Again, that, you know, they cost money. Universities, of course, are, you know, having to make savings in all kinds of areas. And we're seeing evidence that part of that is, you know, in some places is unfortunately in sort of student support. The chances of the government sort of investing here, I think, very much an open question. But yeah, as you said, there's also kind of policy related issues, which, you know, always as ever speak to a lack of join up between the Department for Education, which in theory is sort of, you know, got the welfare of students in its brief, but then with areas like the Department for Health and Social Care and housing as well, where it has an enormous impact, you know. And some of these policy issues, I'd still like to know a lot more about, you know. I think they can sometimes appear to be sort of quite simple. Oh, why doesn't the government just sort of get on and do this sort of stuff? If they were just better joined up, it would be solved. I do think some of them are probably quite, in fact, intractable around things like, say, GP services. You know, we sometimes hear people saying, you know, surely students should just register with a GP, both near their university and near where their permanent address is for students who travel, you know, to a new area to study. But I imagine, you know, knowing what sort of state the NHS is in, that and also just sort of how GP surgeries work, that in fact, that's a very, very difficult thing to get right. And it's kind of complicated also by, you know, lots of the students were saying in the qualitative comments, there were at least a couple where they sort of said, you know, why would I register with a GP near my university? I don't live anywhere near my university. You know, they're traveling from, you know, a very long distance away to be there, you know. So lots of these policy questions, I think, are actually incredibly fiddly. And really, they do need, you know, a sort of dedicated task force, government time, a new strategy to get right. Unfortunately, we really don't seem like we're in a place where something like that is going to be materializing anytime soon.
I think one of the positives in the report actually was that 39% of students were saying their health had improved after coming to university. So I think 36% were saying it was better and 3% were saying much better. I mean, 27% indicated that their health had got worse, but there was a high percentage that were saying actually they feel better being at university. So I thought that was quite a positive thing. And I think that maybe speaks to some of the work that teams like Chris's team do across institutions to put the support in place for students when they get there. The thing that's been interesting to me about when I was digging into the research that was done was just how much more support is needed based on how many students are identifying as having mental health or physical health conditions. And I think there's an article in The Telegraph that was saying between academic year 2016-17 and academic year 22-23, there was a tripling of reported mental health issues, which equates to about 300,000 students, 16% of them. And similarly, UCAS said between 2011 and 2020, there was a 450% increase in students declaring mental health conditions, which probably is a good thing. It shows that there's much more willingness to talk about mental health. But I suppose the question that raises is, are universities able to cope and are they being resourced at the right level to cope in line with the number of students that need that help? And are students being signposted correctly to the help that's available? And I think, again, with my work hat on, are international students where there's maybe cultural differences and cultural sensitivities around some of that asking for help. How able are the students to actually find it? And are the universities able to cope with the growing demands of not just the volume of students identifying as needing help, but also the diversity of students as well?
Yeah, and the interesting thing there is, of course, you know, for our home students, they are all very aware of the NHS, they've experienced the NHS for a long time. And actually, you know, some of the comments in the survey showed a really clear understanding of the fact that the problem lies at the NHS's door, that services aren't connected, that they feel that they, you know, kind of let down by their health service as opposed to being let down by their university, which is important that they recognise that it isn't our job, you know, and I've said it on this podcast before, you know, universities provide, you know, additional support because, frankly, you know, it's the right thing to do. You know, we know that there are additional specific pressures that come with being a student, and therefore it's right that we provide support for that. But unfortunately, our services have become a default stopgap for the NHS. You know, it's okay, you're at university, there are services that you can access. And I'm reassured that the students in the survey don't seem to be saying, you know, I'm let down by my university, they need to hire more counsellors. What they're saying is, I'm let down by the NHS because they should be able to support me better. But for international students, they're coming and actually paying a fee to access this. So, you know, from their point of view, they have not experienced it. They don't understand what it is. All they know is, okay, it feels like private healthcare to them to a certain degree. Oh, at least I can pay to access some health. And then they get to experience the service that everyone else experiences as well, which, you know, is a double whammy, really.
Yeah, I think just also turning back to the policy side of things as well, I mean, just reading this and thinking, you know, what's government saying about these questions recently? I mean, I think it feels to me like student mental health is even less off the sort of policy radar than it was under the Conservatives, which I think is very much not what we would have expected. If we were doing this show a year ago, we'd be talking about, okay, you know, Labour's going to start sort of thinking seriously about some of these sort of student welfare issues. You know, but if you actually think about, you know, what's come up in Parliament, what's been in the papers, where the government's focus seems to be with higher education at the moment, I mean, you know, pending more developed stuff coming fairly soon, you know, but if, you know, if we contrast it with under the Tories, where, and especially when Robert Halfen was minister, you know, he really was someone who was personally driven to, you know, pressure universities to do more. Whether that's the right approach is another question. As Chris has been saying, it would be nice if the government would do more too, but he was looking at things like, obligatory signing up to the mental health charter. He set up a task force, commissioned the review of student suicides and things like that. Whereas, there was stuff going on in government. Whether it was the right stuff is another question. But at the moment, it just does feel like it's not really on Labour's agenda. And, they're so focused on, both the financial sustainability questions and, arguably on some of the sort of free speech issues. That's where the policy attention has been. And yes, it is very much not what you would have thought.
It's been a big week for elections around the world with an impact on students and higher education. Chris, what's going on?
Yes, to the world of the world, I suppose. Interesting elections taking place in Canada last week, where the Liberals, led by Mark Carney, of course, pulled off a quite incredible turnaround from where they were in previous months to retain their power. They may have a minority government, but that's far better than it looked like they were going to have just a few weeks ago. And similar things appear to be happening in Australia, where they head to the polls this weekend. Nothing is for certain, of course, but it seems that the incumbent Labour Party, who have been trailing in the polls for much of the run-up, are likely to retain their power. So it's an interesting international picture that we sit in, of course, with the context of everything going on with the US as well. One of the interesting things in Australia has been that the Labour Party announcing very recently a last-minute change to their visa fees, increasing visa fees, seen as a move to tighten the number of international students. And I think immigration continues to be a key issue for other countries and therefore their higher education sectors, and it's interesting for us to see what happens there and learn from it, especially in the context of course the local elections and the mayoral elections, which are happening in England today. Reform predicted to do very well, and Labour are trying to fight against that tide by projecting themselves as a party who will be tighter on immigration and making noises that they perhaps not made in the past around, tightening that particular issue, and international students inevitably being swashed up in those numbers. There was an interesting comment from Labour MP Jonathan Hinder this week, MP for Pendle and Clitheroe, who's in talking about immigration said, well, obviously, if we tighten these numbers, that will mean fewer international students. I think there are too many universities anyway. And if people say that universities might go bust as a result of tightened immigration, I'm not that bothered. And that's a real red flag for the sector, that these issues very quickly come down to our desks, and the argument that needs to be won about international students being a positive, a net positive on the economy and not being seen as part of the net migration numbers is an argument that still seems to need to be won. So yes, interesting times.
But let's take this back to Australia and international students, Rachel. So just sort of unpack for us a little bit, please, will you? What's happening ahead of the elections? The election is coming weekend, isn't it? And the policy change about student visas and any very early indications about how the sector there is responding and what the impact of that might be.
Yeah, so it's been interesting. As Chris said, the visa fee is the thing that's hit the headline most recently. I think as of July last year, the visa fee had gone up from $710 to $1,600. It's been suggested it goes up to $2,000, which is a kind of 181% increase in under a year. Pretty off-putting, especially as it's non-refundable, unless for very kind of specific reasons the processing team make a mistake, or they don't process it at all, or actually if the student dies, they get somebody gets their money back. But to go back a few steps, it was December 2023, they introduced Ministerial Direction 107, which was trying to kind of manage the surge in student visa applications, and by prioritising institutions that were deemed as low risk. So kind of high profile institutions were given a lower risk status and their visas were streamlined. The impact that had was institutions classed as higher risk obviously then faced slower visa processing times, and often the higher risk universities, and I think they were called level three, the language they used, they were recruiting from riskier markets anyway, so there was extra compliance put in place, and they did notice a big drop in success of student visas being approved. And obviously that led to financial challenges, which isn't unusual across the sector here in the UK either, based on what we've talked about already. But particularly universities in regional areas were really impacted. And kind of approximately 60,000 fewer education visas were granted as a result of that. But then December last year, they kind of revoked Ministerial Direction 107 and replaced it with Ministerial Direction 111. And the primary objective, as I understand it, for ND111 is to ensure they're calling a more equitable distribution of student visas amongst education providers. So what they're trying to do is make sure that people are, they're not loading up Sydney and Melbourne as cities, not just as universities, with students, are making sure that the visa processing is spread out across all institutions. Particularly, I think the benefit here will be universities in more regional areas or that have a slower visa processing capacity because of their size. So I think the positive impacts are that it's more balanced and it's more fair. I think the negative impacts will be for students that are already confused by all the changes that have happened. I think students were already adjusting to the fact there were caps. Universities were months down the line of communicating what that would mean for students. And there's been this rollback slightly in the change to MD107. It's not never a level of detail that most students will kind of understand, but the messaging that has to come out as a result of it is very confusing. I think in the UK, certainly, we're always sitting thinking, well, what might this mean? If a student can't get into the University of Sydney or Melbourne or Monash, what might that mean for the Russell Group? Or what that might mean for somebody that wants to then think about another institution of that calibre somewhere else? But I think based on our emerging futures research that came out yesterday, Australia still is the preferred destination for a lot of international students, because beyond kind of getting in, they can, at the other end of that, at the success end and the graduation end, the post-study work visa is excellent, and the ability to get experience over numerous years, not just 2 years like in the UK, is still the most attractive thing. We know that that's what's driving student demand and student choice, is the ability to work, get work experience, not necessarily emigrate and have permanent residency, but certainly work for a sustained period, get the work experience they want, feel like they're getting a return on the investment that they've made, and then maybe taking that back to their home country. So I think although Australia has been muddy with some of the changes that I've made, I think it's still, students are still seeing it as a really, really great destination for all the benefits that come outside of the degree as well.
Michael, I mean, one of the other things we've seen, isn't it, about the Trump and students in the US and his attacks on universities there, is that they, you know, US students might increasingly be looking to go abroad.
Yeah, I think they certainly will be. I mean, if you look at sort of what's in the Indian media and things, you know, there's stories of students being detained and deported, you know, they cut through very clearly and very quickly. You know, that the potential, and you think likely decrease in numbers to USA is kind of good news for the other Anglophone recruiting countries. You know, as Rachel said, like, it's not always that students will have their heart set on a particular country. You know, they may well be applying to different countries. If they don't get into Sydney, you know, then they'll be looking at coming to King's College London, for example, or something, you know. So, you know, I think the crisis in the USA is the really big thing. But I think also what we've seen in the two different elections is interesting news, mood music. I mean, it's been fascinating how much, I mean, and very depressing, how much the Australian higher education sector has been under attack, kind of from both sides of the political spectrum in the run-up to these elections. And then on the flip side, it's also very interesting that the Canadian elections were just basically not about immigration or student numbers or anything like that at all. Whereas, you know, if you told people that 6 months ago, they'd have said, what, do you not read what's in the news? Like, you know, the student numbers got very, very politicized and very linked to housing and to sort of net migration numbers and asylum and all kinds of things in Canada. But, you know, just the arrival of Trump, his, you know, land grab to try and make Canada the 51st state, tariffs, that was all the elections were about. And that was why Mark Carney won. So there's a sort of, you know, interesting sort of volatility there that, you know, I think Labour, with their sort of very short-sighted focus on reform doing well in the local elections, you know, that should not be the basis for a good international student policy. And where we are in, you know, 2029, when there's the next general elections, the world is going to look entirely different to how it does now, you would think.
And that you know, I mean, I don't, it's not part of the government, but that Labour MP talking about he's happy for universities to go bust, presumably not the one that he went to, or the one, it was Oxford, doesn't it? Yeah. Or, you know, where he might be sending his children, or he doesn't have one of his constituencies. Is that right, Michael?
Yeah, no, that's right. He's just, I forget exactly the name of his constituency, but it's just north of Burnley, where my dad's from. But I think it has a further education college, but not a university. Yeah, I mean, obviously he's a backbench MP in a sort of, you know, red wall sort of seat. But there was also an anonymous government source that was speaking to The Guardian this week, where they were saying, you know, on the doorstep, people don't make a distinction between graduate visas and small boats. Which, you know, that was sort of, you know, government briefing ahead of the white paper. And it got a lot of sort of derision on social media with sort of pollsters saying, oh, well, actually, I've spoken to, you know, focus groups and they do, you know. But I think it does tally with how the government sees, you know, the total net migration numbers being the real thing. You know, that's the real issue. They're not trying to sort of fudge it and to sort of make the case to the electorate that certain kinds, you know, what they're really doing is they're saying they want the numbers overall to come down, and that's going to be the, you know, the overriding Home Office directive for the next few years, I think.
What's been, I'll come in on the US as well. We did our, IDP did a post-election survey in February to kind of assess international students' perceptions. And actually 52% of respondents were more favourable about the US post-Trump's win. I think that was, 3 months ago now, we're rerunning that survey at the moment. I think it will have changed significantly given some of the big policies that have had, shall we say, pretty chunky impact on international students who are already in the United States. What we saw during the last Trump term was, not through IDP, but generally about 15% drop in international students going to the US. And that was, it was quite mild comparatively with what he was doing at the time with international students in mind specifically. I suspect that drop will be much more than 15%. So I think, to Michael's point, we've got an opportunity as the UK and as other destinations, you know, we know that Germany, Spain, France, Hong Kong, Malaysia, they're all really competitive at the moment for students going to those countries as well. But if we think about it from a UK perspective, you know, we've got an opportunity to really try and appeal. We've got the same, we win on the same ground. We win because we've got quality of education and we've got quality institutions. That's the messaging we have to get out as the UK to say, do you know what? You were thinking about the USA, but let's come to the UK instead. But also, I think to your point at the start, Mark, international students are in the USA wanting to get out as well. Like we've always been a really welcome destination for US students coming to study in the UK. There's universities in the UK that do incredibly well from the US. I'm thinking about St Andrews and Oxford and Cambridge. There's no reason why we couldn't be doing more of that, particularly offering them, you know, an environment that they might not feel able to operate in while, or succeed in rather, as students while Trump's in post. So I think there's two opportunities for us. There's how do we reposition ourselves for international students that would be choosing the USA, but how can we become more attractive for students who are already in the USA that might want to come and do an undergraduate, even a study abroad year or a master's programme at our institutions here, given we win on the same quality measure.
So that's about it for this week. Remember to go in deep on anything we discussed today. You'll find links in the show notes on wonky.com. Don't forget to subscribe, just search for The Wonky Show wherever you get your podcasts. And if you want to get ahead of everything that's going on in UKHE, just click subscriptions on the site to find out more. So thanks very much to Rachel, Chris and Michael, who also makes the show happen behind the scenes. We'll be back next week. Jim will be here. Until then, stay wonky.